Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 23rd, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speakers are Larry Rasmussen and Daryl Tremue. Today's session number is 1 and is titled Jesus and Power, Black Theology and Black Power in Christology. Let's listen in.
Daryl Tremue from Wright Divinity School and I, Larry Rasmussen from Union Theological Seminary in New York, want to do this session on Jesus and power, but with the focus really on black theology and black power and the understanding of Jesus Christ there. This week at Holden, we're talking about Jubilee and the references to Leviticus 25 and the 50th year in which the slaves will be released, the land will get a sabbatical, debts will be forgiven, lands that have been taken from peoples will be returned to their ancestral owners, etc. And since the topic of this session is Jesus and power, I want to relay along to you the passage in Luke's gospel where Jesus picks up the Jubilee theme as his own calling, if you were, as the kind of messianic platform. Luke 4, when Jesus came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, he went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day, as was his custom. He stood up to read, and the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to him. He unrolled the scroll and found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has appointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." And he rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. The eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on him. Then he began to say to them, "Today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." To proclaim the year of the Lord's favor is to announce Jubilee. And thus the other items, the oppressed go free, the blind receive their sight, the captives are released. Daryl is going to lead us into black theology and black power. I thought I would just make a couple of comments linking that to Jubilee and say something about the contexts of the development of liberation theologies. There are many different kinds of liberation theologies, of which one important one is black theology. But they share characteristics. So first, just a couple of comments about the Jubilee. This passage from Luke 4, in which Jesus is identified as the liberator and the proclaimer of the Jubilee, is, as you heard, a reading of the scroll of Isaiah. So it's Isaiah 61. The prophetic tradition carries the Jubilee vision forward, and it's a characteristic of a number of the prophets to provide a social critique of their society on the one hand, and the kind of vision of the reign of God, or in this instance, the Jubilee is an expression of that, in the other. And it's characteristic of liberation theologies never to divide faith and the life of faith from the rest of life. You just don't divide it. You don't say, this is economics, this is politics, but this is religion. It just doesn't work that way. Neither do you separate the sacred from the profane. All of life is under the rule of God. It's also characteristic of liberation theologies in a variety of modalities to pick up certain strands of scripture as touchstones. The Exodus experience is very important in liberation theology, whether it's Latin American liberation theology or black liberation theology, the release of the slaves, the making of a people who were no people, the prophetic social critique and the prophetic vision, Jesus the liberator, Mary and the Magnificat, also in Luke, in the first chapter. And Mary is actually reflecting Hannah's song from the Old Testament. So, my soul magnifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God my Savior, for he has looked with favor on the lowliness of his servant. Surely from now on all generations will call me blessed, for the Mighty One has done great things, and holy is his name. His mercy is for those who fear him from generation to generation. He has shown strength with his arms. He has scattered the proud in the thoughts of their hearts. He has brought down the powerful from their thrones. He's lifted up the lowly. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich empty away. These are the reversals, the great reversals, and that one also get picked up in liberation theology. Well, the last thing I want to say about sort of context and characteristics of liberation theologies now in our time is that all of them are socio-critical theologies. It's understanding of Christian faith from a point of view that does social analysis and social critique as the part of the way of doing reflection on faith itself. They're socio-critical theologies that arise from group experience and group identity. That's why it's black theology, because it's done out of the black community's experience as a community and done in critique of the society in which it finds itself. Latin American liberation theology is the experience of being poor, generation after generation. And that group experience of being the poor and the oppressed is the theology is done out of that and with a view to the society. There's usually a focus on public suffering or the suffering that happens in the society and among these people. And as I said before, you don't separate faith and religious experience. This is something, I won't say it's new, but there's a clear break here from the way in which a lot of theology has been done. European theologies, the ones that you and most of all of us in this room were brought up on, was theology done in the church and passed on out of an in tradition of the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment thought that you could think and about what you ought to do from a place that transcended race, creed, color, national identity. And the effort of the Enlightenment was to find a way, a place, from which one could talk about doing theology as the Christian doctrine of, they used to say, man. I mean, one could talk about human nature and just do a theology that was true of human nature wherever it found itself. The theology that I had grew up on, whether it was in catechetical instruction or wherever it was, never distinguished the group identity and said that that was important to the thinking about Christian faith. It just assumed you were talking about God and human nature, and that was sufficient grounds. And so it never really understood that it was reflecting a particular culture. All theology does, all of our thinking does, of any sort, reflects its context. Okay, maybe that's enough, because the liberation theology is said to the theology is done in the dominant culture. You're passing along to us your culture, and you're calling it theology. Or you're speaking in the universal voice, but really you're passing along your own particularity. So when the missionaries came and moved into work among the native peoples of this country, they said, you need to get rid of your traditions, your language. You need a different education. What we're bringing to you is Christianity. And of course, it wasn't Christianity. It was European Christianity, and it was a particular culture. But out of this particular tradition, they thought they were talking about human nature and what all of us need. All right. That's maybe sufficient background, because black theology, liberation, Latin American liberation theology, feminist theology, womanist theology is now done out of self-conscious recognition of the role of our group experience. And we don't just have one identity, so you end up thinking about the faith out of multiple identities. Daryl?
Thank you, Larry. Indeed, the particularity of theology has come to a certain extent in full circle. I have a friend at the Society of Christian Ethics, where Larry and I are members, Robert Craig, who's now working on new approaches to white male theology,
yes.
Which is then a declaration that theologies are done out of particular situations, contexts, lived experiences, when a certain kind of historical circumstance and economic system. Well, having said all that, I'd like to make a kind of a little survey. I always love these little surveys. And then I'd like to share with you some materials. How many of you either believe or approve of black power? Okay, that's a few. How many of you believe or approve of white power? Not quite as many, but still some. I often ask that question in the class I teach in Fort Worth, Texas, Brad Divinity School. It's a Disciples of Christ affiliated seminary. It's ecumenical. We technically have more United Methodists as students than we do Disciples of Christ as students. Another story. But really, and my classes tend to be about, I'd say, 85% European American. Rarely will I get most European Americans will say they either approve or believe in black power. This place is significantly different. And I account for that because of the popularization and the demonization of black power in current American public discourse. So that black power is only John Carlos standing on top of the Olympic Towers and the black power salute. Okay, well, black power is only Huey P. Newton posing with some rifles and spears. You see what I'm saying? In other words, most people do not want an idea of power in which domination becomes natural as an experience to suffer under, rather than to exercise faculties and abilities, which is really what power is about. Well, we talk about black power and black theology as really kicking off with James Cone's movement of the late 60s and 70s, and particularly his debate with J.D. Otis Roberts, and then almost an exponential branching out of that kind of theology and black power. But I'd like to share from you from my text. They told me to the bookstore to plug it. No. So here it is, Voices of the Silenced, about a bishop, actually, that I had written about, who is an historical figure and one of the antecedents to the black power debate. Henry McNeil Turner, who wrote in 1898 the following statement. Quote, "We have as much right biblically and otherwise to believe that God is a Negro as you Bukra or white people have to believe that God is a fine-looking, symmetrical, and ornamented white man. For the bulk of you and all the fool Negroes of the country believe that God is white-skinned, blue-eyed, straight-haired, projecting-nosed, compressed-lipped, and finely robed white gentleman sitting upon a throne somewhere in the heavens. Every race of people since time began who have attempted to describe their God by words or by paintings or by carvings or by any other form or figure, have conveyed the idea that the God who made them and shaped their destinies was symbolized in themselves. And why should not the Negro people believe that he resembles God as much as other people? We do not believe that there's any hope for a race of people who do not believe that they like God. That's from Henry McNeil Turner. Well, that was received in a very excited fashion in 1998. And in fact, if he had not been well connected and a bishop, I think Henry McNeil Turner would not have written much else afterwards. But in fact, he did live well into, well, not well, but into the 20th century. So you have these antecedents in a number of people, Henry Highland Garnett, Bishop Henry McNeil Turner, a number of women. But to really talk about the black theology and black power movement, you have to talk about James Cohen and his work, in which he begins to associate, or rather incorporate, an understanding of black theology into black power. So, and the reason why that's important is because of the fact that the black power movement, as it was popularized and demonized, was oftentimes associated in contradistinction or in conflict with what was called Negro understandings of Christianity, in which reconciliation is, of course, one of the primary purposes or projects of God, and in which the issue of racial identity of God, either historically or symbolically, is not discussed in polite company. But in fact, you see that, you know, the Solomon's portrait of Christ, the Swedish Jesus, prevails. So it's kind of a subtext that that doesn't go on. So I'd like to share with you a little of Cohen's first work, the groundbreaking Black Theology and Black Power. Moreover, it seems to me that it's quite obvious who was actually engaged in the task of liberating black people from the power of white racism, even at the expense of their lives. They are men, and let me hesitate here, this is before anything like inclusive language. So he's using man to refer to humanity in ways we don't find acceptable anymore, but here it is. They are men who stand unafraid of the structures of white racism. They are men who risk their lives for the inner freedom of others. They are men who embody the spirit of black power. And if Christ is present today, actively risking all for the freedom of man, he must be acting through the most radical elements of black power. Ironically, and this is what white society also fails to understand, the man who enslaves another enslaves himself. Unrestricted freedom is a form of slavery. To be free to do what I will in relation to another is to be in bondage to the law of least resistance. This is the bondage of racism. Racism is that bondage in which whites are free to beat, rape, or kill blacks. About 30 years ago, it was quite acceptable to lynch a black man by hanging him from a tree. But today, whites destroy him by crowding him into the ghetto and letting filth and despair put the final touches on death. Thus, whites are enslaved to their own egos. Well, that was radical in 1969 when that was published. Let me share a little bit, a clearer explanation of what Cohen means when he talks about black theology being, or rather Jesus being black. Bear with me here, because I'm going to have to read a little of this for this to make sense. For me, the substance of the black Christ issue can be dealt with only on theological grounds as defined by Christology's source, Jesus, scripture, tradition, and social existence, and content, Jesus' past, present, and future. I begin by asserting once more that Jesus was a Jew. It is on the basis of the soteriological meaning of the particularity of his Jewishness that theology must affirm the Christological significance of Jesus' present blackness. He is black because he was a Jew. The affirmation of the black Christ can be understood when the significance of his past Jewishness is related dialectically to the significance of his present blackness. On the one hand, the Jewishness of Jesus located him in the context of the Exodus, thereby connecting his appearance in Palestine with God's liberation of oppressed Israelites from Egypt. Unless Jesus was truly from Jewish ancestry, it would make little theological sense to say that he is the fulfillment of God's covenant with Israel. But on the other hand, the blackness of Jesus brings out the soteriological meaning of his Jewishness for our contemporary situation when Jesus' person is understood in the context of cross and revelation. Without negating the divine election of Israel, the cross and resurrection are Yahweh's fulfillment of his original intention for Israel to be, again, a light to the nations, to open the eyes that are blind, to bring about the prisoners from the dungeon, and from the prison those who sit in darkness. That's, again, the Isaiah 42 passage that is the source of the Luke 4:18-21 passage that Larry read earlier. Well, excuse me, I know it's hard sometimes to listen to a lot of quotations, and I do tend to read rather rapidly. But what I'm trying to do is give you a good amount of material for us to discuss. And commenting a little bit further rather than reading it, what Cohen is trying to get at is the fact that God comes into the world and comes into the world to help people out of situations of oppression. To do that, of course, God comes as an oppressed person. Okay, could really very easily come out, come into the world as an oppressor and destroy oppression. The victory over oppression is the victory of Jesus as the scorned one, as the stone that people has rejected, as coming historically, literally, into an oppressed, conquered community of being a Palestinian Jew in a Roman-dominated world. And the way that is appropriate, as Cohen would put it, in terms of understanding that Jesus is black, is the state of subjugation that African Americans find themselves in this country and Africans find around the world. So that blackness becomes a symbol of oppression and yet also a symbol of triumph over oppression, in that Jesus does have a triumph over sin and oppression, but not without going through that experience. So that Jesus then becomes a person that oppressed people can identify with and gives insight to non-oppressed people, indeed, of both their need to be in solidarity with oppressed people and also of the real humanity of people who are oppressed, of people who are despised. And I'd just like to finish with, again, a quotation. This one is from my book, talking about Jesus. I know Shaler Matthews had books earlier in the century about Jesus, in which Jesus is essentially an Oxford Don, you know, a very erudite, very upper class. But the Jesus I write about is a little bit different, and I'd like to just share this with you, because I relate Jesus and, in fact, the Christian moral life to meeting human needs. And so I talk about a theology of basic human needs. Indeed, why do we pray as we've been instructed by Jesus for our daily bread in the Lord's Prayer, if not but to eat it? What sense does it make for Hebrews to leave Egypt for a land flowing with milk and honey if the drinking of milk and the eating of honey in a free land is of no real consequence? Even manna from heaven is a divine indication that God approves of the physical nature of human beings. Whether one interprets the text as a historical event or simply as an important religious metaphor, this reasoning reaches its logical conclusion with the physical incarnation of a person of the Trinity who is born of a real Palestinian woman, who immediately becomes obligated, as presumably all other mothers do, to feed and clothe him. She must meet the basic human needs of the infant Jesus with the cooperation of an earthly husband, with whom she must flee to Egypt when Herod threatens their security. Thus, the biblical narrative suggests the suitability of doing a theology of basic human needs. Then I skip down. What is clear, however, from the biblical text is the fact that God acts in this world because this world is important to God. Moreover, God in the person of Jesus acts most revealingly in the world as a responsible self, who even in canonic Christology, that means self-evacuating, kind of a submissive understanding of Christ, never sheds humanity in needs. Thus, in the person of the Son of God, incarnationally situated, we have a Jesus who eats with whores, publicans, and other social undesirables, to such an extent that he is accused of being a drunkard and a glutton. He's also criticized by Pharisees and scribes for healing a man on the Sabbath, because the man needed to be healed right then, at that inconvenient time, for religious formalists. Jesus reminds his critics, who are willing to pull animals out of pits on the Sabbath, that even animals have basic needs that God desires humanity to attend to, even if in doing so they appear to violate the sanctity of the Sabbath. So also does Jesus justify David's consumption of sacred bread, dedicated to cultic worship, which it is shown is subject to commandeering under certain circumstances, such as meeting basic human needs. Jesus must even resist the criticisms of his own disciples, who are angered at the waste of a profligate woman who has purchased and used a costly perfume in the preparation of proper interment, one of the earthly Jesus' last basic needs. And then finally, in the Garden of Gethsemane, we also see a Jesus who does not relinquish life casually, but asks that the cup of sacrifice might pass him by. Even the Christ of the resurrection, who no longer has any earthly needs, willingly attends to cooking a breakfast of fish for his disciples to help them meet their basic needs. This picture of Jesus is neither novel nor hostile to traditional Christian doctrine. For centuries, Christians have resisted Christologies that were docetic, that is, that denied the full human nature of Jesus. So what I have tried to do in terms of continuing the conversation of black theology is to begin to show that Jesus came into the world as a Jew to help lift people out of oppression. That one of the ways to understand oppression is to understand not only the exploitation of people, but also the disabling of people from meeting their most basic human needs. So I've tried to join discourses and theologies that talked about liberation and freedom, which I see is only one basic human need, towards a whole understanding of sustainability as being the projects of God. God creating people, therefore, as not as angels without needs, but as created material beings with needs, and therefore the project of God being for people to join together, morally speaking, physically, socially, economically, and otherwise, to help each other meet their basic human needs. That's why I talk about a Jesus Christ who has real needs and helps people meet their real needs. Well, finally, what do we get out of this understanding of theology? Well, Albert Klieg started a Shrine of a Black Madonna in which he makes certain absolute historical claims that Jesus is somehow not only black in a kind of a symbolic instance, but as an historical figure, Palestine being a lot closer to Africa than it is to Europe. Most people in black theology and black power have said, well, that may be the case, but that case need not be made because of the fact that we understand the fact of historical accident. That is, Jesus would have to be born somewhere of some definable ethnicity, and even of some definable gender. So, the color of Jesus' skin is therefore interesting, but not so very material, except to the extent that it is made an issue in our society. So that when Cone's book comes out and he talks about God being black or Jesus being black, it becomes a scandal, if you understand that, only because of its appearance in a world in which Jesus of Palestine really is represented as Jesus of Stockholm, and in which the notions, Northern European notions of Christianity are read backwards into history, into Palestine of the first century, and into Judaism of previous centuries. So that really black theology is an attempt from a particular community to talk about and interpret the African American lived experience in a liberative and sustaining fashion to liberate everyone. And that's why I started with asking how many people believe in black power, how many believe in white power, because indeed people do need power. And that's part of what God's revelation is to us, how we are to exercise the power that God has endowed us with. So that's kind of the thing I wanted to present here. I went a little further than I'd like in terms of time, but I did want to cover a lot of ground and show a little bit of development there. So do you want to rejoin or you want to have questions?
Let's just open it up.
Yeah, let's open it up. Yes.
I don't believe that we should say it's either black or white power, but it's unified power with whatever group you're talking about. It shouldn't be one or the other. It should be community coming together, all different people that live in that area, and work together for whatever power is necessary to meet the needs of the people.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I guess thinking that I like the Enlightenment's idea of it's all one theology, but that it's the details are different. It's when you get to the particular details that being a woman matters, being black matters, being from a group matters. That in the we are all one kind of a notion.
But what do you mean we are all one what?
One group of folks loved by God who loves variety and loves the different kind of interactions that might come. And so the details are all different, but at a summed up highest level type of thing. It is interesting to think, as it was just mentioned, that Jesus is black or Jesus as Asian. The idea of Jesus as white is a new idea, or Jesus as female is a new idea that will be fun to play with. But isn't the oppression issues of a woman and the oppression issues of an Asian very, in the details they're different, but at the 30,000 foot level, aren't they similar issues?
I think oppression has a certain level of similarity, because I think that people basically are one in terms of human existence. I don't think that women and men are that different that they somehow constitute different species. Okay, so that, yes, I guess my answer is at some point there is a base humanity. My only quarrel with that is that there's a tendency for people to want to harmonize things ideologically and analytically. And sometimes in doing so, they want to move to sometimes either reconciliation or, for instance, colorblind societies without really appreciating what has been done or correcting what has been done to women, to African Americans, to Mexican Americans, and if you really read some people carefully, to European American males who find themselves defined in certain kinds of ways, bracketed in by a society that won't allow them, at least in my generation and observing European American males, you couldn't cry. To cry was to be a girl, or to be feminine, or to be weak, so that there is a certain kind of bondage for everyone in this state of affairs. And then I think, as Larry correctly pointed out, the refusal to name particularity has, in effect, a kind of imperialism in terms of its effect. You can still see it in theological curriculums when people will say things like, a title course will be Systematic Theology, rather than Systematic Theology emanating out of a European American male tradition, which would then locate, you follow me,
right,
and acknowledge the location.
Yeah, the quote coming to mind right now is, life is lived in the details. And so maybe...
Who lives life at 30,000 feet?
Yeah.
It's more comfortable up there.
Can I just make a comment? Because I think the intents and purposes are correct about all working together. And I do think there is a common humanity. I think it's meaningful to talk about justice as a norm pertaining to all, or freedom from oppression, etc. But I'm very concerned, and the reason we titled this Jesus in Power is the recognition of different levels and quantities of power involved when you do that. If everybody gets in on the say of what that human nature is or what justice means, sort of does it that way and arrives at human nature, that's one thing. But just to use your example of, if I'm a Minnesotan, if I had said in my community in Minnesota, now here we've got an issue in front of us, let's all of us now work together, come together around that issue. What does that mean for Native Americans in Minnesota? How would they get in on it?
They're usually not even at the table.
They're not at the table to start with. If I showed you a map of the continental United States in 1500, it would be all Indian lands. If I showed you that map now, you'd have 2.3% would be Indian lands. So if I say, let's all get together, the question is then, on whose terms and with what kind of participation. I was actually 50 years old before I found out that the city that I lived not far from at all, Mankato, Minnesota, was the site of the largest lynching in U.S. history of Native Americans. And the judge in that case said, there are 50-some Native Americans lynched, said, we're not altogether sure that these particular Indian men were the ones that did it, but we know that Indians massacred the whites. So we will string them up. I took, along with everybody else in my class, in sixth grade, a year of Minnesota history.
Jeez.
There wasn't a mention of that in Minnesota history. So when it just now, if I try to read my own history from the side of the oppressed, I have to be self-suspicious about my own appeals for let's all address this problem or this issue together, if I am not aware of the history that now means in my part of the state, I don't live there any longer, but when I did, that would have been simply consigning the native peoples of that place to my own amnesia.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, well.
Just to pick up on that, Falwell, who was a historian in the state of Minnesota, there's a hall at the University of Minnesota named after him, now wrote of that generation. Uh-huh. And he talked about the men going to the gallows singing Dakota war chants. Uh-huh. More recent scholarship says they went to the gallows singing the baptismal hymns that they had learned in the prison and been baptized before they were hung. Uh-huh. Who's telling the story?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. Shifting gears a little bit, and I came in late, so maybe you answered this in your earlier comments, but what I heard you say, Daryl, is very absent in the pole of the church that I grew up in, and I grew up very much in the church. So would your analysis be that, you know, what we call the church, what we call Christianity today in this country, has so missed the boat that it's indeed not really Christianity?
I'm not willing to admit that, because I've never really studied Christianity or outside of this country. And for me to say missed the boat completely means I'm in the water. So, I know I can only tread water a certain amount of time down I go. I do
but it's
think,
not, I mean, it's not a Christianity that yeah, talks I, about yeah, the oppressed. You know, it's yeah. really comfortable folks.
You got me there. You got me there. I mean, you know, I think you're absolutely right. I studied with John Howard Yoder, a Mennonite, who talked about the Constantinian shift, in which Christianity starts out as a religion of oppressed people who are under Roman subjugation. But through the action of God, you have Romans who are Christianized, but a strange transformation occurs in Christianity, in which now you begin to have Christian, and we go back to the issue of power, you begin to have Christian ideologies, theologies, doctrines that now have Christians in positions of power, Christians as agents of government, Christian soldiers, Christian executioners, a Christian wielding of power, but oftentimes this is not accompanied with, as Larry would put it, as a self-suspicion that now that we are no longer subject to Diocletian or Nero throwing us to the animals to be eaten alive, now that maybe we're emperors or agents of the emperors or certainly at least subjects in an empire, perhaps we need to still be careful about how power is used. I mean, for all of the insight of St. Augustine, an African who is also one of the founders of the church, he very much still associates the Roman Empire, which by this time is Christianized, with almost, not exactly the city of God, but it certainly is a manifestation of God's power in the world. So that Vandals who are attacking this empire are to a certain extent demonized, and he doesn't really get at the issues of what does it really mean to be oppressive, particularly if you are a Christian. If Jesus is against oppression, which doesn't come clearly out of that kind of theology, then it's very difficult to get at oppression as being sin. And so a lot of our Christianity, including the Christianity that's founded here, sees that kind of oppression, slavery, or genocide, as being the establishment of a new Israel, as being the establishment of order, as bringing a kind of order out of chaos, of turning a wilderness into the realm of God. I mean, if you look at all of the basically the manifestos of the conquistadores, starting with Columbus. Columbus says he's here to bring for, you know, the flag of Ferdinand and Isabella, Christianity to a savage and heathen world. And so Columbus does bring a certain kind of missionary impulse. One of the first things Columbus does is, of course, take slaves out of the New World Native Americans. You know, but there's not a conflict there in that understanding of Christianity. Okay, because heathens could be enslaved, primarily because they weren't Christians. You see, and that follows up again on that kind of dichotomy of saying, well, yeah, we can reduce somebody's social stature if they happen to be pagan or heathen, because we will, by doing so, also share with them the gospel, which will save their soul. And then that's the final reality. So the fact that we put them in irons and take them out of their native land inures to their benefit because, you know, in terms of salvation, they are redeemed, their people are redeemed, and they become children of God. So yeah, there's a problem with our Christianity, and I think we've been trying to dig out from under that ever since. And I think black theology is just one particular excavation to dig out from under that kind of bondage. And of course, there are others, as we talked about earlier.
I've just lived for 12 years in Salt Lake City, Utah, and we've been members of a congregation. It's nice and Lutheran right downtown, and we have about 100 people coming each Sunday. And I feel like I've come out of war camps. One of the things that I became aware of quite early on in those 12 years was that many of the LDS people were using the same words that we use in our talking about the New Testament, Christianity, about different theology, but the meaning was completely different. And in the last couple years, I've even become more frightened when I realize how much we Christians are saying this term means out of the Bible, or this parable means out of the Bible, how we live it out as compared to how it's written in the New Testament. Jesus says, give alms to the poor. He doesn't say, ask them if they're going to go buy alcohol with it. We say, channel it through the agencies. And when I say that, even my own pastor was going, well, you have to be realistic here. You know, and I understand that we have to be realistic, but sometimes we need to go back and see the words of the New Testament and see the radicalness of what Jesus is asking us to do. He's not asking us to show up at for 1 hour church on Sunday and maybe sing in the choir. You know, he's asking us to become one with the oppressed, to find out what it's really like. We think if we have a drop in salary or we lose our job because of downsizing, that we are the oppressed. But if we have a college education, hey, we've already got a box that we can check that a lot of people can't check. You know?
That's a good way to put it.
The advantages, you know, that I had growing up in a Lutheran pastor's family, even though we didn't have a lot of money, we were considered in a different class because of my father's education.
Sure.
You know, but you're talking about oppressed people who maybe have had absolutely no education or maybe a couple of years and they had to work as children in order to help support the family. The parents might both be, you know, drug and alcohol addicts so that they're living in that environment all the time. How are you supposed to lift yourself up out of that by your bootstraps, you know? We don't let oppressed people do that, because we want our advantages. So we're not willing to say, okay, you know, I'll quit buying this, you know, item because it is made by children in Korea or children in Nicaragua who are 6 years old and sitting at looms for 12 hours a day or whatever. Are we willing to say I don't want my brand name shirt because of that? It's a tough life. When you start really talking about the questions that Jesus brought up, don't bring two cloaks with you when you go out. Bring one. Don't bring a purse. Don't bring money with you. Go preach the gospel. That's frightening. That is really frightening. You know, when we're saying, don't let your kids out of your sight and don't go hitchhiking, it's too dangerous and there are mass murderers out there. You know? And Jesus is saying, go out with no money and no extra clothes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The question of power is always a little difficult, for me at least, to deal with. When I look at the New Testament, we see that Christ was tempted, and one of the temptations was the temptation of power, political power. And personally, I have to believe that was real. It wouldn't have been much of a temptation if it wasn't realistic that he could have taken over the Roman Empire through his charisma or some means actually become the political leader of the world. And yet he rejected that power. And so I've got two questions. One, is there such a thing as good power as opposed to bad power? And how, as a Christian, do I distinguish between the one and the other?
That's a really good question. And that's kind of the heart of this presentation. You know, I think I studied with Jose Miguez Bonino, who used to be the president of the World Council of Churches and is a well-known liberation theologian. One of the things he pointed out to me is Christians have had a tendency to say that all power is God's, and then basically through the rest of their doctrine, carve out little slices of power for their own individual uses. So, you know, the distinction between power and domination is a fine one. I try and get at it by talking about basic human needs, by saying that there's a connection between our faculties, that is, our powers, and our needs, and that it makes no sense to say that a human being is complete and is able to sustain, let alone flourish, unless they can at least, on a base level, meet their basic human needs. That's why I say I believe in white power and black power and women's power, you follow me, because what I'm saying is that people have to have sufficient faculty, ability, capacity, energy, power to take care of themselves and those around them. Now, when you move from that level to the power of communities, it seems to me that it is, to me, obvious, almost self-evident, that communities have to be able to take care of their basic human needs, okay? Now, when you move beyond that to what I call desiderata, that is a variety of things that people could want and a variety of exercises of power, that's when I think, essentially, we need more public discourse to talk about various exercises of power beyond that. Because I think it's at that point where you can move from power to domination. And I think, as Larry pointed out, if you get all the people who are affected by a decision at the table, at the decision-making time, then the element of domination, I think, is minimized. Mm-hmm. Would you like to go further with that?
Well, just to carry on there, because I think your initial point is an important one. Jesus doesn't reject power. Jesus rejects dominating power. I mean, the scriptures and actually Christian hymnody, Christian liturgy is just full of use of the P word. You know, it's interesting that there's a strong tendency for Christians not to want to talk about. Some Christians not to want to talk about power. Other Christians, if you don't have it, you talk about it all the time.
Sure.
But the scripture is just full of it. It's the refrain in the Gospels is, and Jesus, in the power of the Spirit, went about doing this and that. And they marvel at him because of the exercise of power. But the temptation is this kind of ruling, dominating power, commanding the legions, whether of armies or of angels. And the kind of power that Jesus shows in the Gospels is this capacity to create community from those who have been outcast and rejected, and to bring them into the same community with some others who belong in more privileged ranks, whether it's a Roman centurion or what. So it isn't a question of do we exercise power, it's what kind of power and what kind of capacity. And I think the paradigm that shows up from the Exodus experience itself, which is where the Bible actually begins with the Exodus experience. Later on, Genesis is written when the people realize that the same one God who liberated us is also creator of the whole cosmos. But what you have at that very formative event is the creation of a community from a people who were not a people. And you see the same thing in the Jesus movement. It's a creating of a few people from those who were not included as a people. So the outcasts sit at a table. That's why I think for us, it's so vital. I'm just repeating, actually, what Daryl said here. But it's so critical for us when we ask, what is Christian exercise of power now, to ask, how is it that you create community from those who have been not included? When I was growing up, first of all, there was a problem in my sort of catechesis. That is, the pastor never... I don't have recollections of pastor preaching on Luke 4 and taking the liberation of the oppressed as a theme, or taking Mary's Magnificat and the rich shall be sent empty away. I just never remember that being preached upon. So that's one problem. But I do remember, and it's impossible to overlook it. I do remember in catechism and in sermons and liturgy and so on, that Jesus went to the outcasts. I mean, that was a theme. But the point, the way it always got resolved, it was always read individualistically. That is, yes. Jesus would go to that outcast or that prostitute, and if that prostitute were liberated, what would happen? She would join us. I mean, if she were really freed, she would then come and be part of us. It was an individualistic reading in the way Jesus treated people, and then we were the reference group. Right. We were the normative community. We didn't make community with those who were outside our community. They were socialized into our community.
Yeah, good point.
And so black theology and black power was a momentous. It really upset me the first time around, because the claim was that a whole people's liberation was what God was after, and that I was going to have to, as a white person, make community with a whole people and not have blacks be socialized into a white community on essentially terms of dominating power.
I just want to say one quick thing about power. I'd like to add where the power comes from, because we as humans, and during this age of self-improvement and, you know, raising your self-esteem, we think that the power needs to come from within us, where really it's a conduit that we need to be. Jesus emptied himself.
Yeah.
He spoke to his Father. The Holy Spirit then spoke through Jesus. And that's what we need to emulate, is not saying, oh, that was a good idea, I think I'll think about that and make a decision. It's more being open to letting God work through us, and that's where the power is. It's God's power, it's not our personal power.
Yeah, and of course that is finally what made the movement around Jesus in it authoritative on its own. That is, there wasn't any sanctions that could be brought against it and the members who joined it that could keep them from doing and saying what they wanted to say and do, having been filled with the Spirit. I mean, water washed, Spirit born. Having been filled with the Spirit, even the threat of death wouldn't turn those folks around. You know, and so that's real power. You know, you get modern day examples of that. When the high school kids in Soweto, South Africa, said, "We're just not going to learn Afrikaans, thank you very much," and the soldiers said, "All right, we're going to take you to prison." They said, "We ain't going." The soldier shot them, and they said, "You can kill us, that's all you can do, but right behind us there'll be a whole lot more." That was the beginning of the end for South Africa as an apartheid nation, because they had been filled with some kind of spirit that even said the threat of death doesn't dominate us any longer.
Well said.
Yeah.
Yes. You were getting to an area that I live in Seattle, in a neighborhood that is multiracial. My children go to an integrated school, but our church is not really integrated. I mean, nobody is unwelcome as far as I know, but it certainly is a white church. And I think that what I have seen in 25 years of thinking about civil rights and multicultural perspectives is that people still like to go to church with people who are just like them. And we can't make people go to church together with people who are different from them. And I wonder what reaching out and being in community with somebody else means to a white congregation in the middle of a multiracial city.
Good question.
Or what does it mean to a white congregation not in the middle of a I mean, I serve a church that's a suburb of Chicago, but it's a very white suburb, and it's a very fluent suburb, and they're Swedish and very comfortable. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean now?
I think one way to begin to get at it is go to an African-American congregation and see what it feels like, see what kind of hospitality you receive. We've talked about this a number of times this summer, and people have said, and I know this to be true myself, that you welcome very warmly in general at an African-American congregation. And the feelings that you'll feel at that congregation are the feelings that African-American people will feel at your congregation. So it's a great way to get the answer to your question and to put yourself out there to begin to resolve something. I mean, ideas will come to you as you sit there for how to help your congregation to begin to behave in such a way that African-American people would actually find it a boon to come. And, you know, there's something to be said for worshiping separately, but having events that kind of combine folks together. But, you know, Holland Village has been wildly unsuccessful in helping African-American people to feel comfortable, or poor people, or Hispanic people, or any people that aren't, you know, middle class. Even the young people who come up here who are a little disenfranchised and work as volunteers feel like outsiders, and they're white, and their parents are middle class, but they don't see this stuff that's going on here as part of it. So the alienation that happens, it's endemic, and we need to kind of throw ourselves. I think we need to throw ourselves into alienated situations in order just to understand what it feels like to be alienated.
Yeah. First time I ever sat in a college class where I was in the minority racially. Was really surprising to me, and I already knew individually some of the black kids, but to be one of two in a class of 25, have you ever done that? You know, whether it's blacks or anything. Since then, I've lived in Hong Kong, so I was very used to being in the North. But the first time, it is really eye opening to even just sit in a room that you're in the minority.
Yeah, I'd like to follow up on what the two of you said. I mean, at least once a year, I'll go to a colleague's church. She's a Disciple of Christ minister, as is her husband, and they have Camino de Paz, a Hispanic disciples church. And my Spanish is good enough that I get a good 1/10 of the service. You know, they sing those songs and they end in just the right phrases that I can translate. I understand it. But, you know, I think it is necessary for us to be alienated, at least occasionally, because the process of going through that, of being alienated, helps you to understand how really culturally particular your church is. Mm-hmm. That, you know, you do certain things a certain kind of way because you were born into churches that did those things that kind of way. And you meet the holy, I hate to put it this way, but you meet the holy in the familiar.
Sure.
You know, we talk about sometimes God is so far off. But I remember going to a Serbian Orthodox church in Croatia. They were translating the homily there, but just having, I don't speak any Serbian or Croatian or old Slavonic either, you just feel surrounded and almost overwhelmed, and yet you feel the presence of God also. And that's the part, I think, that gets us back to that common aspect this gentleman made reference to, namely, that we are all created in the image of God. That we are all the children of God, and that finally we all have the capacity to experience God because we've been created to celebrate the presence of God in community, together. And when you go to those churches that are unlike yours, where you are alienated, you still, if you're in the Spirit, have the capacity to experience the Holy. Now, is that something you can do every week? I know I can't. But I think it's healthy and good for us to do that on occasion. Do you know what we're doing time-wise?
Yeah, we should bring it to a close. I did also want to respond to this common situation and add to the comments that have been made, namely, mourn one another, visit one another's churches. Another note. As a white person, whose education has been Euro-American, that's also my church tradition. I mean, the hymnody, the liturgy, the language is that. Through participation now over a while in the World Council of Churches, it's been just very interesting to see how the ecumenical movement has bitten the people who have been a part of that, and how liturgy, hymnody has evolved with the intermixing of traditions. And it may start with another tradition explaining itself to you and welcoming you as a part of that. But if you live with it long enough, you find that you develop a liturgy. You start writing songs. You both begin to appreciate other traditions, and you start creating some together. At that point, I think one has moved. What I think is a wrong response is one which denigrates, denies, degrades one's own tradition.
That's a good point.
I mean, as I said before, we need to be self-critical about them. Are they in fact oppressive? And if they are, what is it about that? They don't need to be. But that isn't any reason to denigrate them as what one brings to a common table.
I think one of the more interesting models is the model of Teze, where they sing Latin, so that they won't be singing either English or French or Spanish or German or any other language that anybody knows. They sing Latin because it's equal. Everybody will be equal.
Yeah.
And so everybody has to look. It's equally difficult.
Yeah. In World Council circles, we don't go to Latin. But but you know if the verses there for the songs or the chants or so on may be in several languages, so you may choose one familiar. But what is, like Gerald was saying, what very often happens is that you are taught enough to sing it in that language, even though you don't know the literal meaning. You can still sing a Russian chant in Russian. I mean, it's spelled out phonetically there. And there's something amazing that happens when you get inside another culture by that way, even though you couldn't for your life, to save your life, talk beyond that chant. It's still the power and the presence of God because of the particularity that you've now entered.
Yeah. Last word, I think, is going to go to Diane.
Nonsensical question. When we went to the Green Book, we added some hymns to be more inclusive than were never in the Red Book.
Yeah.
But still, I have never been in a Lutheran congregation that can sing Lift Every Voice.
Oh. You got to come to ours then, but it's because we're, you know, we have folks who've been singing that all their life.
So it's church to go to, yeah.
Well, Trinity, come up to Trinity Evangelical Lutheran on 100th and Amsterdam.
Location does help.
Although I have to say one more thing, because I'm not one who's real pessimistic about possibilities here. One sign that you're at the beginning edges of a Reformation is the quick succession of hymn books, new hymnals that are introducing new kinds of music from various traditions. And now with One Voice, or what did we have? We had hymnal supplements. If you start looking at the variety of traditions that have been introduced into there. I don't know if your church is picking up on them. We are, and it's adding so much to it. I mean, they're just different expressions. And it's a different sense of the spirit that comes with different kinds of music. Sometimes very interesting texts once you start looking at them that you wouldn't have written yourself. Lift Every Voice is an example. You know, so I take the fact that there have been more new books of worship and more new hymnals put together in the last 25 years than any time since the Reformation to indicate that the Spirit is a movement in some important way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.